Welcome to the Dying to Live podcast. I'm your host, Richard Brendan. My special guest today is best-selling author and internationally known grief expert, David Kessler. He's going to be sharing insights from his book, Vision Trips in Crowded Rooms, Who and What You See Before You Die. But death truly is a mystery. That's why I've always believed that hospice workers are midwives to the mystery. And because it's a mystery, there's a lot of things we don't fully understand about the process of death. You probably have spent some time with someone in their final days, and you might have noticed that the following strange yet common occurrences have happened. Your loved one spoke of beings suddenly appearing in the corner of the room. They may have carried on conversations with these invisible beings. They may have talked of preparing to take a trip. They seemed able to see into a world beyond this one, or perhaps they chatted incessantly with a family member who died years ago. Well, such experiences are the focus of David Kessler's new book, Visions, Trips, and Crowded Rooms, Who and What You See Before You Die. The renowned grief expert and co-author with legendary Elizabeth Kubler-Ross of Life Lessons and On Grief and Grieving takes on the two frequently dismissed experiences of the dying. I know in my hospice experience, I've actually had on several occasions similar experiences, what I've heard people talk to people in the room. I remember one time there was a couple of us right after the patient passed away, and we all saw a vapor trace following them. Well, David Kessler, he's one of the most well-known experts and lecturers on death and grief. His new book, The Needs of the Dying, was the number one best-selling hospice book, received praise from Mother Teresa. Kessler's work has been featured on CNN, NBC, PBS, and Entertainment Tonight, and he's been interviewed on Oprah and Friends. He's been discussed in the New York Times and the New Yorker. He's also a contributing writer for Oprah.com as well as AOL.com. I followed David's work over the years. I heard about this new book. I was so intrigued by the stories because actually stories like this, I think, give us not only hope, but they also give us comfort. And through all of that, they can also teach us a lot about love, because love never dies. It's eternal. So it was a joy that David agreed to come on our show. He often guest teaches for Marianne Williamson out in L.A. during her Course in Miracles class, and he's got a busy, busy schedule, but he's joining us today from his home out in Los Angeles. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
I've always believed that death is the most democratic thing on the face of this earth. It will take all of us and affects all of us. And with your background in death and dying, I've also believed that our destiny will always find us. And I was intrigued to read in the beginning of this book how your destiny found you at a very early age.
Yeah, people will laugh. You know, they'll often say to me, you know, why did you choose this profession? And I'll say, oh, it kind of actually chose me because, as you know, are alluding to, when I was 12 years old, I had grown up with a mother who was in and out of the hospital and, you know, did not have a great death when I was in my 12th year. So it certainly impacted me and changed my life. And I think, you know, most of my life now is helping people have a more meaningful experience than I did, you know. Death is always going to be tough and challenging and painful, but I hope I can make it just a little easier and more meaningful for others.
Yeah, you actually also talked about how through that whole experience, I won't share the whole story, but dealing with death in the medical world, becoming a reserve police officer, learning to fly a plane, all of that probably came out during that experience, didn't it?
Absolutely. I tried to become someone who either could help that little 12-year-old boy or everything I wish that 12-year-old boy would have known.
It's also important to point out to the listeners that this book is very much a book about hope.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that years ago when I worked with Kubler-Ross on our first book, Life Lessons, you know, to me, the message of that was we have now, and let's make the most of now, and let's live in the now, because, you know, life is fleeting. Mm-hmm. And certainly with writing this book, Visions, Trips, and Crowded Rooms, Who and What You See Before You Die, I realized that based on the interviews and the research, I think, you know, we're pretty much eternal, that we're actually going to go on for a long time.
I'm glad you mentioned Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You did author two best-selling books with her. But also, you were with her at her bedside during her passing. I didn't realize that.
I was. We had done life lessons, and then we went on to do On Grief and Grieving, Finding Meaning Through the Five Stages of Loss, and really spent that last decade of her life with her. And, you know, I think a month after we finished the book, On Grief and Grieving, she called me and said, come down. And when I walked in, she had taken a turn for the worse and, you know, was beginning the process of transitioning from this life, as she used to say, or graduating to her next one.
Mm-hmm. How many years ago was that, David?
That was in 2004.
Okay, okay. Now, I read somewhere where you were telling a story when you were with her. She asked you a question. She said, what do you think about the deceased visiting those on their deathbeds to greet them? And what was your response to that?
Well, she talked to me about that early in my career.
Uh-huh.
And I remember kind of feeling like, oh, I don't want to go near that subject. I'm trying to have some credibility here. you know, who knows whether people, you know, whether the dead greet the dying. I had no idea. And, you know, I put it off. And Kubler-Ross sort of had a sense of, oh, when you're more mature, you'll be, you know, willing to explore this, you know, this conversation and this phenomenon. And hopefully I'm more mature now and, you know, I'm confident and willing to explore this. And I think the other thing that's happened probably in those 15 years since her and I had that conversation was that I witnessed so many people having visitations at the end of their life. Mm-hmm. And I saw their family members walking away thinking grandma went crazy at the end of her life or grandma was seeing things.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they don't realize what a common phenomenon that is. And I actually have a duty to do some work in this area and do some interviews to help point out to people that this is a normal and common occurrence, deathbed
mm-hmm.
visions and our loved ones coming to greet us when we die.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book that your hope, your great purpose for this new book is to begin a conversation, a continuing dialogue for healthcare professionals to discuss more than who died, but how they died. How do you think healthcare professionals are doing now in terms of being open to these extraordinary experiences?
Well, I don't think we're at the place now where we share it as openly as we could. I talk about how, you know, most healthcare workers in any hospital or hospice I go into and talk to them, you know, they all kind of say, well, of course our patients, you know, everyone's got a story about someone who was dying seeing a loved one coming to greet them.
Mm-hmm.
But yet when patients were coming in our hospital to die or in our hospice, you know, when we were preparing them and say, this might happen to you, that might happen, we want you to be prepared, we don't say to them or their families, and it's not unusual for people to have visitations from people who have already deceased that may come to visit you. We don't sort of normalize it and let them know it's common.
Mm.
And I think that was sort of the, you know, what was fascinating to me about this book is I really tried to interview doctors, nurses, clergy, mm-hmm. rabbis, priests, social workers, you know, all members of the healthcare team to really get their stories, people who were credible and didn't really have a reason to sort of, you know, look into this world other than they're just reporting on what they've seen over the years.
Absolutely. So are visions proof of an afterlife?
Well, to me, they really pose an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
What if everything we knew about death isn't true?
Mm.
You know, what if we don't? Well, what if the whole thing about you're born alone and you die alone and it's a lonely experience, what if that's not true? What if we are born and people greet us at the newborn nursery and then when we die, there is another group that greets us? And what if everyone we've known and loved is there to meet us? And dying's not this lonely, empty experience, but rather a full experience where there's standing room only. And everyone we've cared about is there to help us.
Yeah. And we are hearing more and more and more of those experiences from those who are close to death. Can you talk about the difference between a deathbed vision and near-death experience?
Sure. A deathbed vision is when someone is dealing with an impending death. They truly, truly are going to die and do die. It usually happens anywhere from an hour to a week before death.
Mm-hmm.
The person who visits the most is our mother. Not surprising that the person who greets us when we're in coming to this world is also there, usually to greet us when we leave.
Hmm.
And the only people who are left to talk about this are either our family members who witnessed this or the healthcare workers. The person who is dying has gone on and passed, so they are not here to tell the story about it anymore.
Hmm.
In a near-death experience, someone either almost dies or is clinically dead for a few minutes and is brought back to life, and they themselves are then here to tell the story.
I believe.
So, you know, one person's return to life, that's near death, which I didn't write about. The other one is the person who actually does go on to die and has these visions as they're dying.
Your mother died when you were 12. How long ago did your father pass away?
1987.
And did they have experiences that you talk about in the book?
It was interesting when my father was dying. I felt like at a certain point he became very sad and very depressed and very hopeless. And then at a certain point, everything changed for him. And I wasn't sure really what had changed. And he shared with me how our mother had came to see him. Not our mother, my mother, his wife. And he realized, I'm going to be joining her. You know, I'm not leaving the world and everyone I love here, but I'm actually going to a place where my wife and everyone else is. And he said, you know, and I'll see you again. And it really changed him from someone who was dying hopelessly to someone who was dying full of hope.
Talk about believing the words of the dying, the last words that they say, the final words that they say.
Sure. I think one of the things that was an interesting discovery in writing the book is I was curious about how do other walks of life experience the words of the dying, and I was surprised to look in the legal field to find out that the law recognizes the words of the dying as very pure, very important, and that they, the law says we should believe the words of the dying. And there have been criminal cases that have been decided upon what the dying person says. And not only that, the dying declarations have actually gone all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court made a ruling that those words, those last spoken words, are so pure of the dying that we should always consider them as sacred, if not more sacred than an oath.
Yeah, that is amazing, because they say somewhere, I think this was in the medieval English courts, that a dying person is not presumed to lie.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct, exactly.
In each of your chapters, you begin a chapters with a famous person and their last words, and it was interesting to read the final words of Thomas Edison right before he passed away. He said, "It's very beautiful over there."
Exactly, and I think that was surprising to realize that this is, you know, as much as we may think this is a new phenomenon and some people have said, oh, it's part of the New Age movement, well, I went back and saw that this was in medical journals back in 1914.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, there were stories in there. And one story that I'll always remember that was fascinating to me is of a woman back then in the 1920s, I believe, who, as she's dying, she sees her sister who's alive.
Mm.
And the doctor and everyone goes, well, we know she's hallucinating because the sister's in another city and she's alive. She's not dead. And the woman goes on to die. And then they, you know, get a letter 3 weeks later that it turns out the sister had died a few months ago. And so she actually, you know, was seeing someone in the afterlife that no one else knew was there. And, you know, I share a story in the book of how that even goes on today in a new way, that there was families who, this generation has both parents to care for, and we're also working generations, and, and there was one family who ended up having to put their father in a safe sort of Alzheimer's community where he would be locked so he wouldn't be able to wander out of the community, but was a nice community for him to live in. And at a certain point, their mother was sick, and she was in a a hospital, another facility. And at one point, she took a turn for the worse, and they're kind of discussing, should we bring Dad over, and would Dad know he has Alzheimer's? And Mom starts saying, your dad's here. I see him. He's here for me. And they think, oh, gosh, now she's hallucinating. And wondering, you know, should they bring him over since Mom's dying? And yet Mom's saying, he's already here. He's right in front of me. And then their phone rings, and it's the other facility saying that the dad had passed away. Hmm. And there's no way she could have known that.
Hmm. How many stories do you guess you've collected so far from professionals?
Well, I'll tell you, that's sort of, you know, why it's a little hard to keep them all straight in my mind, because every time I lecture, people come up to me with, you know, one story after another. I did a very popular article and TV piece for CNN, and there were over 1,000 pages of comments of people who have stories. So they're just sort of coming out of the woodwork these days.
Oh, was that the one?
People are willing to talk about it.
Was that the one entitled, Do the Dead Greet the Dying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do the Dead Greet the Dying.
Very well done. When it comes to visions, in all the stories that you heard, is there a particular story that really sunk deep with you that you do remember? Maybe not.
I think just that, you know, there was a number of ones that were of children who came.
Mm-hmm.
There was just so many that I think have been comforting. I think the ones that really surprised me were the stories where maybe they didn't get the person who they expected, but they got someone they didn't know. I mean, there was one person who shared a story of a man who came to greet her as she was dying, mm-hmm. and she had no idea who it was, and the family checked later and realized that it was her biological father who had put her up for adoption or years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those stories of people who, you know, no one has this information, and yet they see things and know things that are always startling to me.
I was really fascinated to read the section about deathbed visions in the arts, that all throughout literature you find that in a lot of the classics.
Absolutely. And, you know, I talk to people about how common they are, that they've sort of made it into our world. We don't really know that, you know, there's so many scenes in movies and plays and where the dead do come back, and even if you go back hundreds of years, you can see that. And this is an archetype that's been around, and it's even around in modern movies. That, you know, at the end of Ghost, Patrick Swayze goes on to walk into a crowd of people. Titanic, there's a flash of a crowd as they, you know, after they died. There was a movie that Clint Eastwood recently had out, The Hereafter, that I had a counterpart who shared in it how striking these stories are and how similar they are. And that, I think, what has made them so common to go through art for years and to be in literature for years is that these have been around probably since the beginning of time. Hopefully we're now just willing to admit it and talk about them a little more.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, you mentioned that Clint Eastwood film. The picture, the photo they used for promotion is strikingly familiar with the one on the cover of your book.
Absolutely. Same photo, and, you know, I did some work with them on the promotion of the film, and I thought in a lot of ways they depicted things quite accurately and, you know, tried to be as exploratory about this conversation as they could.
Hmm. I've heard it said that people die as they live. Have you found that to be true in all your work in death and dying?
I often say, you know, people die in character.
Uh-huh. What do you mean by that?
That if someone is, you know, an angry person, I think we have a fairy tale vision that we'd love for them to sort of not be angry as they go into their last year or last month.
Mm-hmm.
But people tend to die in character, that, you know, who they are is sort of who they die as, and they don't often have a miraculous personality turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
However, I do think that you see that moment when people are in fear about dying, and as I look at all the technology and everything we have for the dying, the one thing that does seem to always comfort the dying is when it seems the dead come to greet them and realize they're not going to be alone in that transition.
Yeah. I appreciated your take on spiritual and religious visions. I'm just going to read from your book. You say, interestingly, I've never come across anyone who experienced a vision outside of his or her own faith. In other words, a Jewish person doesn't see Jesus and a Christian doesn't see Allah. However, the belief in angels seems to transcend most religious boundaries. You know, I know we can't prove any of that, but I've always had this sense that's probably what it is. It's really based on our own religious tradition in terms of who or what we see.
Absolutely, and I think it even points to a larger part of this phenomenon is that we're not confronted at death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one had a religious figure they didn't believe in, as you just read. No one had an enemy show up from life. No one had anyone that wasn't comforting. You know, so that's sort of the good news is, you know, our enemies don't seem to greet us. And there were people who I know were had interviews done that had patients who did have real fear about, you know, would the husband who was an abuser be there to greet them at the end of life? And luckily, it turns out that does not seem to be what happens.
When I think about some of these visions, I often think of the phrase angel of death. And I think if you look back in literature, it's such an ominous, dark figure. But programs like Touched by an Angel, I think, have hopefully change that around. And you mentioned in your book that your friend Marianne Williamson, who's been on this program, once remarked, she said, "I used to think that it would be a terrible thing to behold, but I now realize that the angel of death would have to be God's most tender and understanding ally."
Absolutely, and I think that is sort of that sweet thought about, you know, when we think of the angels and all that, that it wouldn't just sort of be a random angel. That would be one that God would know. This is such a scary, sacred moment that it would have to be just the sweetest, most tenderest angel to be with us at that time.
What's fascinating about this topic, we've been talking about visions, and you have so many compelling stories in this book, by the way. You also talk about a second experience that many people have shared, and that's getting ready for a trip.
Absolutely. It's really interesting that people at the end of life will talk about, got to get my tickets, or got to get ready to get on the plane, or the passport, or the bus, and there's some sort of archetype about a journey that they seem to know they're taking.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say it's fascinating because it is, you know, death is the trip of a lifetime, and they don't. It's not a heavenly perception people have. No one, you know, sort of says, "I need to wait for the chariots to ascend to heaven." They all kind of say, you know, "Where's my bags?"
Yeah.
And people don't realize that actually the roots of hospice come from a way station that used to be the place where you would rest before your final journey.
Isn't that amazing when you consider what really hospice is about now?
It is that place where maybe we are taking our final rest before our long journey.
Hmm. Beautiful. Talk about also some of the crowded rooms that you were talking about, the third phenomenon. What is that all about?
That's, yeah, very interesting that people when they're dying will often say, "Did the doctors round last night? There was a crowd of people in my room." And they use the word crowds over and over again. And so as we explore this more and begin to ask questions about it, people would say how, you know, maybe they saw their parents in the crowd, but they didn't know who everyone else was, or saw a few people. And we realized that they are seeing this group of people who are clearly waiting to greet them.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't often identify all of them, but it is that challenging thing about what if we are met by all these people the same way we gather at a birth? What if in the afterlife we all gather at a death? And we, you know, meet someone as they arrive.
Hmm.
And people find that crowd very comforting.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do. You mentioned early on about Mother Teresa. And by the way, somewhere in your book, I think Mother Teresa's last final words were, "Jesus, I love you. Jesus, I love you." It's always intriguing when you are able to know the final words of deeply spiritual people. It's really an expression of how they lived.
And she was a remarkable person. I was, you know, I'll always be grateful for the kind words she talked about my first book. And, you know, she is someone who was very helpful to me in this world. And was just one of the kindest, happiest people. I would say she probably was the most happiest person I'd ever been in their presence.
I wanted to ask.
You could feel the happiness coming off of Mother Teresa.
I wanted to ask you about that experience because you did meet her. You were at the Home for the Dying Destitute in Calcutta. What was that total experience like for you?
Well, very different than America. We have so much technology here, and I remember when I sat down with her, I said to her, we have so many resources for the dying in my country, and you have so few here. How do you do it? And she looked at me like a silly boy, and she said, the dying need tender, loving care, nothing more.
Hmm.
The dying need tender, loving care, nothing more. Hmm. I think about how much technology we throw at the dying here and forget about that tender, loving care, and that is what makes a difference at the end of life.
Mm-hmm. What other experiences have you had abroad?
I think just traveling to other countries and seeing how they do not hide death the way we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can remember growing up and you'd be driving somewhere and you'd get in back of a funeral and, you know, you'd be late and there'd be a whole, you know, procession you'd watch.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen anymore. The dead move around our country in white unmarked vans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go to another country and you can see the dead being carried through the streets as they're on their way to, you know, their final resting place or cremation, and it's just a different experience, where here we sort of pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah. I've noticed in smaller towns, David, that when there's a funeral procession, people will often pull over and stop, almost out of reverence, where in larger cities you don't see much of that anymore.
No, and I think in an interesting way we long for that. I do think that there is, you know, we talk about even when an ambulance gets a call, they say, you know, man down. That we are a society that when someone falls down, we take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
We're also a society that we do not allow you to be buried where you die.
Mm-hmm.
When someone dies somewhere, they are always taken to another place to be buried. And that's a sign of a civilized society. And because we don't have those opportunities, that just in our daily life to go, oh my gosh, look, someone passed away. Let's stop and show respect for them and give thankfulness that we're still here for this moment. We don't have that a lot of times. We just tend to get that from the TV. And I think that is why public grief is growing so much, because that is where we're getting our experience now.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Sometimes when I've been present or I walk in after someone had died, like in a nursing home, you'll see some aides in there, and they probably don't know any better, but they're shuffling around and cleaning the sheets. And it always felt like something sacred had happened. And I read something from John O'Donohue in one of his books. And interestingly, John just passed away about, well, 2-3 years ago now. But he wrote, a deathbed is such a special and sacred place. A deathbed is more like an altar than a bed. And it's really that, the difference of how we look at something like that, that it really is a sacred moment that takes place at a person's transition.
I always say that, you know, when you're in the presence of someone who's giving birth, you can't help but think you are seeing the arm of God working, that there's just something profound about that moment. And in the same way, when you're in a room and someone's dying, it has that same profoundness.
Mm-hmm.
You just know there is something huger than you going on right before your eyes, and you're only can tune into one channel on that TV, but you know there's 100 other things going on you can't see.
Yeah. David, I'd like to ask you, how did you get involved with many of the celebrities that you have in terms of helping them deal with grief with family members?
Well, I'd like to tell you that, you know, there's just something special about me, but I think the reality is, you know, the honest answer is when you live in Los Angeles, and you know, you do this kind of work and you write books, you know, people just tend to want to seek you out. And some people I was, you know, privileged to sort of know, and other people did seek me out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've certainly learned that no matter who you are, whether you're rich or poor, famous or not, we all do die the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes when you have a little more fame, there's a little more complications, but we all basically live and die the same way at that moment.
Your services have been used by Elizabeth Taylor, Jamie Lee Curtis, of course, Marianne Williamson. Also, Tony Perkins, Anthony Perkins, and Michael Landon. What was Michael Landon like? Was this for him personally?
The amazing thing about Michael Landon is Michael Landon really wanted to get a blood transfusion to go on the Johnny Carson show that we were all scrambling to make this blood transfusion possible so that he could feel better to do the Johnny Carson show. And he wanted to go on the air, and he wanted to say cancer. He wanted to say the C word. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to kind of go on and joke about this and be real and authentic with people. You know, he didn't want to go on and sort of give a gloomy, I have cancer, here's what it's like speech. He wanted to be himself. Mm-hmm. And he was, and I think it was really great, you know, for the world. And at that time, you don't remember back then, you just didn't see a celebrity ever talking about having cancer. He was sort of one of the first.
Yeah, because now they're able to share those things publicly.
Absolutely.
But it's interesting how the times have changed. Speaking of that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the culture of death and dying in this America. We've kind of grazed on that a little bit. I remember the special Bill Moyers did many years ago concerning that. I think it was titled On Our Own Terms. Have you seen a difference over the years in how we are? Are we taking death and dying out of the closet now, or is it still somewhat hush-hush?
I think it's still somewhat hush hush. You know, it's interesting. As much as I've worked with celebrities, I have sort of longed to, you know, have a celebrity approach me and say, you know, I'm kind of willing to go out there and sort of talk to everyone about my dying. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like it's the American way to say I'm going to beat this death, mm-hmm. and I'm going to beat this disease. And I think everyone privately has to contend with that moment where they have to look at the reality of what's happening to them, and that's the moment we don't see. You know, we have those public moments. I always say in grief we all saw Jackie Onassis not crying, you know, at the funeral, at the procession, and people think how brave. Well, the reality is she cried in private, but mm-hmm. we do have this public perception that to be brave and to beat things and to not give in is the best way, and it's not a human way. Mm-hmm. So I am sorry that that part's not out of the closet, that you don't see a lot of figures going, I am dying, it is time for me to go, and it's hard to say goodbye, and I'm going to show you how I'm doing it, or a little bit about my life.
Mm-hmm. You are seeing more funerals taken out of funeral homes, oftentimes in churches and synagogues. You're beginning to see green funerals begin to emerge. So there is an evolvement, I guess, taking place, where years and years ago, people would die in their homes on the farm and children would be around and they would be aware of that. But like you wrote in your book when you were a young man, oftentimes kids weren't allowed to be with the dying. And of course, now they are.
Right, and I often say the children are really the forgotten grievers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that it's very important that we are there with them and we let them express themselves and include them. And, you know, I even know when people are sick in the hospital and dying, people are so worried that the kids might be upset. And we have to realize that, you know, death is upsetting. Sickness mm-hmm. is upsetting, and we have to allow them to have that experience.
Mm-hmm. David, where do you stand on physician-assisted suicide?
I am against it.
Okay.
I certainly believe that everyone has the right to make their own decisions mm-hmm. and to decide their own fate. But as someone who's worked an end of life, I feel like if your best option for a good death is suicide, mm-hmm. we have failed you.
Mm.
You know, and whenever someone says to me they're considering assisted suicide, I don't think about, should I stop them or what should I do or is it whose right is it? I mean, it's obviously their right to do what they want. I always internally think, let me do everything I can to make their death as pain-free and symptom-free and comfortable so that they don't feel the need to turn away to that.
Hmm. There probably is somebody who's listening who has lost a loved one. What can you share with them to help them cope with the death?
I think the one thing I would want to share with them is you probably feel a lot of pressure from the outside world to get past it, get over it, recover from the loss, and you know that's just not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to reframe our thinking to help people realize that we don't recover, we don't get over, but rather the reality is we learn to live with that loss.
Mm-hmm.
That loss stays with us forever. And that's kind of the way we would want it. It won't hurt less. It will just hurt less often. And in time, people do find healing and find a little more peace and find a place to laugh again. And they return to a new normal. But I think I would just let people know, do this in your own time. Don't feel rushed by anyone.
Hmm. Are you pleased with the reaction of the book so far? It's been out for a while.
Yeah, I'm, you know, between grief.com and all the different letters and people I get and, you know, the stories I hear, I'm just so glad that people are sharing and talk about it, and it's won so many awards, and I'm just thrilled it's being seen as a spiritual book, as a medical book, as a mm-hmm. self-help book, as, mm-hmm. you know, a motivational book. You know, as an author, you just think when you're writing down the words of the dying, you just hope it connects with people.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, you kind of go, well, how silly. I mean, how could I think it would not? These are, you know, people's last stories of their life. Of course, they're going to be so meaningful to people.
Yeah.
And I think the surprise is how uplifting, you know, people find the book, and I love that about it.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, towards the very end of the book, you write, so the conversation continues, I strongly believe that we should keep exploring, keep sharing. My hope for this book was to send the same message that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross espoused decades earlier, and that is, we need to listen to the dying. If we allow the dying to be our teachers, we will have open hearts and minds. That's huge.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I appreciate the work that you're doing out in the world and for sharing your time with us today. And again, your website is grief.com. David Kessler, thank you.
Thank you so much for doing it. I really appreciate you and your audience.
I have so enjoyed David Kessler's books over the years, and I encourage you to pick up a copy if you haven't done so as well. And again, thank you for joining this podcast. Get the word out to everyone. Also, the website here is richardbrendan.com.